Good morning. We have a big agenda today. Last time we looked at morality and two crucial errors with regard to moral judgment: over condemnation as against reluctance to judge. And I gave you some homework at the tag end, which we're to finish today, but I want to first do the main talk today and then finish off the homework at the end as a segue into the question period, which I guarantee to conduct today. I've already been authorized to go to 12:30 and even a little bit later to be sure we get substantial questions in. So let us turn to first a related twofold error, very parallel to the two possible errors with regard to moral judgment, but this one centering on two improper attitudes toward emotion. One is an improper reliance on emotion in making a decision. And that, of course, we call emotionalism. And the opposite type of error is excluding emotion from your life and decisions. Usually, you don't even feel the emotion. You automatize its exclusion. That's what we call repression. So it's emotionalism versus repression. Now, we're going to emphasize in this lecture today the second of these. That is the deliberate, methodical exclusion of emotion from the making of decisions, which, as I say, is an error. I'm not concentrating on the other side of it too much, emotionalism, because most objectivists learn the error of emotionalism thoroughly. They get it from day one and from all the reading and lectures. They certainly understand what's wrong with going around expressing their, acting on their emotions rather than their thinking. But the better objectivists, some never discover it. What's wrong with that? They remain emotionless to the end and just call that individualism, but they usually end up as libertarians. But the better emotionless objectivists who do understand that error recoil against it and fall into the other one, the error of repression and of simply pushing emotions aside altogether. So I want to start with a few words on the value of emotions in general and their importance in making many decisions. Not all decisions, but certainly many decisions. And again, this topic arose from a seminar, and I will periodically read the student's formulation because it's eloquent of the problem as real objectivists see it, rather than professors. Now, this paper started off with the statement that the she says everybody knows it's a she, so I'll say she. I was going to make it an old French man, but it doesn't have to be disguised anyway. She started off by explaining that, of course, emotionalism is wrong, and then she uttered this sentence: emotions are merely the product of evaluations. Emotions are merely the product of evaluations. And of course, she meant to say they're not tools of cognition. You can't rely on them to teach you the truth. They're merely the product of evaluations. Now, does any one word strike you as a tip-off in that sentence? I've read it three times with one definite emphasis, a tip-off that there is a problem. Yeah, there is such a thing as being a detective about writing, of which Ayn Rand was the world's greatest. And from your use of a preposition in sentence one, she could determine, she could predict what would be the final conclusion you would come to 40 pages later, which was always struck me as an awesome feat. But here, merely, oh, I'll give the answer. Merely, you knew that, right? Merely is the tip-off. Would you ever say such a statement as, breathing is merely a means of gaining oxygen? Or, eating is merely a means of ingesting nourishment? Now, to say that something is not a means of cognition is not to derogate the function. Which the merely does. It's nothing but that. Every capacity of an organism is equally important to its survival. Emotions are not means of cognition, of course, neither is breathing or eating, etc. And just as the others, emotions have a vital role in life. Now let's just review this vital role briefly. What would human life without the emotional capacity consist of? Well, of course, you'd say no anger, no fear, no pain, but no desire, no love, no pleasure, no motivation. You would essentially be like a plant. You'd have no volition because nothing would matter. No preference. How would you make choices? So your consciousness, if it isn't automatic, would be meaningless as far as a human consciousness is concerned. Emotions are crucial. If you know Atlas Shrugged, there's an emotional gauge which, if you set correctly, is a concomitant of the success of your efforts to survive. And if you have a consistent code of values, the emotional barometer of that is happiness. And if you have contradictions and irrationalities and impossibilities, the emotional concomitant is suffering. So in that sense, they give definite information indirectly by this gauge. But over and above that, there's a simpler and more obvious reason why emotions are crucial, and that is they are the reward for living. They are the form in which you experience the fact that life is an end in itself. So to repress emotions or ignore them or brush them aside in the name of being reasonable is an error, even if that is a sincerely motivated error. Anybody who knows Ayn Rand, or who was fortunate enough to know her, will know that she was certainly not repressed. She felt very intensely, positively and negatively. It was perfectly clear to any onlooker what she felt. And if you want to see, in some instances, read this letters book that Mike Berliner has just brought out, and even in letters which she carefully edited, you can see the gamut from ecstasy to total rage. Now, in deciding on the principles of proper action, in other words, the principles of morality, emotions have no role. That much is true. It's a strictly scientific, rational discussion of cause and effect. What causes? What principles of action lead to and sustain human life? What causes, what forms of action harm or destroy it? That's simply in arriving at the principles of ethics. In applying moral principles, however, we have a somewhat different situation because there are very often options, different choices, could be made by different people, which would be equally compatible with the same moral philosophy and the same moral principle. The simplest example is, morality tells you you should have a productive career, and that eliminates certain ways of life, being a bum, being a robber, being a professor on tenure, say. But that leaves a lot of other possibilities, you know, butcher, baker, a doctor, etc. And in these cases, emotions have some role to play. What is the role? That's what we want to get clear. In cases where the choice is optional, what is the exact role that emotions have to play? That's really the subject of this short lecture. Is it the case that the mind lays out several alternatives which are equally rational in principle, and then you just read from top to bottom with one eye on your emotions, And whichever one evokes the strongest feeling in you, you say, okay, that's it. Is that the proper description of the role of emotions in selecting among options? Obviously, no. That would still be emotionalism. You're just giving yourself a series of stimuli, this choice, this choice, this choice, and you're watching. And whenever you get a burst of visceral jiggling, you say, okay, that's it. Now that would still be emotionalism. That would still be using emotions as a means of cognition, of knowing which is best for you. Well, if that's not the case, is it that you figure out purely by reasoning every concrete decision? Obviously, again, no. Because since it is an option, you have a real choice. So your preference, your feeling is obviously relevant. So what then is the right method in deciding among optional choices? Emotions play some role, but what role? What is and isn't their function? And that's, I want to go about answering that by taking several examples that came from the class, which gradually develop a full answer. And let us start, see if I can see this, I wouldn't have to bend all the time. All right. Let us start with the example of vacations. Now, is it okay to say the young lady? See, now you know that she's female and young. But from my perspective, young could be under 50, so. She basically wrote the following as her understanding of the pattern. She says, emotions are crucial in deciding between optional values. Man is trying to decide where to spend a week of vacation. Some options are clearly disvalues. For example, a libertarian convention, a Cuban resort, or a whorehouse. Those are three well-chosen equal examples. However, there is a range of legitimate options within which it is valid to decide on the basis of what he feels like doing. For example, does he prefer the calm of the seashore, the excitement of a big city, or the beauty of the mountains? Now, she took that as the paradigm. Let me just read you the key formulation. There is a range of legitimate options within which it is valid to decide on the basis of what you feel like doing. Now, is that a valid formulation? Now, how many say yes? How many say no? Well, you're entirely right. Because that pattern would imply that philosophy has one function, and that is get rid of the clearly wrong choices. And after that, it's deuces wild. Just go by your feeling. So if you wanted to pick a vacation by this method, you list 10 or 20 morally valid choices, and then read down the list introspecting, and go wherever your feeling was the strongest. And that is not a proper attitude. You do have to use emotions in deciding among options, but you have to do it at the end of the process of studying the case, not as the whole essence of the decision. Or put it another way, there are two crucial tests that have to be met before you consult your emotion. And what you will usually find is that when you've covered both of these tests properly, you don't have any doubt anymore. In the process of going through these two tests, you will actually shape the proper emotion, and at the end, it will grow right out of, you won't have agony and indecision of what to do because it will be dictated by your analysis. Now, let me show you the two tests on this simple example. Let's call them the reality test and the consciousness test. certainly two, on the face of it, irrelevant things to human decision. By the reality test, we mean you must study the facts of reality that are relevant to the choice in the context of your total values and resources. The facts of reality relevant to the choice in the context of your total values and resources. By resources, we mean things like how much money, how much time, how much strength, etc., how much freedom. Now, it's obvious that any choice of a vacation involves a lot of plain facts. Cost. I have a desire, for instance, to spend 2 weeks in Fiji. That is very expensive. Over and above that, the time involved to get there is tremendous. So just out of the blue, if I made a list of the desired places and went by feeling, Fiji would certainly come out next to Aristotle's birthplace, probably, as a strongly desired. But once I say, well, it's going to cost X thousand, it means at least 3 weeks, etc., etc., the desire starts to diminish in the face of what is required to do it. And of course, time and money are only the most obvious. Are you going alone or with a companion? If you're going with a companion, obviously it's relevant what are his or her interests and choices. What is his and her time frame, assuming you're not paying for the individual? If they are absolutely passionate about the mountains, and a major value to you is being with, I'll say her because it's too much time to say him and her, you may say, I don't care where we're together, I'd rather have her come and go to the mountains than go to Fiji alone. So I have to build that into the facts. And then, it's not always the case that one particular destination solves only one goal. What if you're a student doing your dissertation and you have to choose between a big city and the mountains for your vacation? And you're starting to gather the data and so on, and then it occurs to you that a huge research library is located right in that big city, and that you could take up one afternoon without wrecking your trip, and in the process get in some crucial research, and that would be an associated value if you're the kind of person who can do one afternoon and then just cut it off. Are there reservations available? Are you prepared to settle for a non-ocean view at the right place, or a terrific view of the mountains, but you don't really want the mountains? I mean, you have got, and I'm just giving you scratching the surface here, there are all kinds of sheer facts about a vacation place that you would have to know before you can appeal to your emotions. Your emotions might suggest some candidates, but then as you look into it, you will start to find that the abundance of choice that you had at the beginning is very much narrowed. It's narrowed without you even having to make the decision, because when it's real to you, you can't afford this, you don't have the time for this, your girlfriend hates that, you know, it pretty much comes down to Atlantic City. So, this is one thing you have to do. That's what we call the reality test. Now, but even after you've done that, there is what I'm calling the consciousness test. Why do you have a desire to go to X, whatever it is, the calm seashore, for example? What is the reason for your desire? Is your desire, we'll use the calm seashore, is your desire for calm rational? Is it neurotic or mistaken? Now, I hasten to say, I do not believe in original sin. Therefore, you should not start with the idea, if I want it, I must be guilty of something. It's innocent till proven guilty. And I'm not talking about the need to go into therapy or extended analysis to find out why you want to go to a calm scene rather than a bustling city. We're talking about the kind of introspection which you should be able to do solely on the basis of common sense. It's what Ayn Rand used to call one onion skin. And the idea is, you know, you can keep on unpeeling an onion until there's nothing left. And with real serious major problems, you keep on taking one skin off after the other after the other. But on a common sense practical level where we're concerned with something that's on the face of it is perfectly reasonable, you want to go just one skin deeper to be sure that there's not something wrong or some problem underlying this, that you really endorse this desire. And that is not hard to do. For instance, you want the calm seashore. If the first thing that honestly occurs to you is, my life is tremendously tense and hectic and rushed, and I have terrific pressure, and I have a need to just completely sprawl out. I do not want bustle and hustle, etc. around me. Perfect. That's one onion skin. You don't need any more. You don't have to. This is not a regression to the time when the sperm didn't make it to the egg and compensation for the defeated sperm or any of that. Now in pattern, if you were to find when you look in and just ask in a simple friendly spirit, why do I want calm? And you came up with an answer like this, well, I don't ever like anything that isn't calm. I don't like a new job because it makes me tense. I don't like watching new programs. I just watch, you know, Perry Mason and Dick Clark. I don't like excitement. Then you could say to yourself, well, you know, in my case, there's some reason to think I'm getting in a rut here, to put it mildly, and maybe my desire for calm is a disease. Now, that is obviously just a pattern, and I'm not going to pursue it. But the proper pattern of choice would be, if you desire something, and you decide that your desire is legitimate, and you have looked at the facts that are relevant, and that desire persists in the face of those facts, that's it. The decision is made, you follow the feeling. Do you still want it, whatever it is, after the reality and the introspection check? Now, in rare cases, several desires may be equal. You absolutely can't tell after you go through the facts and the introspection. That's rare, but sometimes that's the case. If so, flip a coin. It doesn't make any difference. Or just pack and whatever you put in the suitcase first, follow that. Because you've said by definition, every conceivable relevant thing is already taken care of. But the much more common result is that the analysis will exclude some destinations, make others more feasible, highlight the motivation that really means the most to you. In other words, little by little, without you even knowing it, you will end up shaping your own desire and even dictating your own choice. And it'll be dictated by the survey of the facts and the introspective data. The final decision, therefore, will not be via arbitrary emotion. It'll be via an emotion that you yourself have shaped by a study of reality and your desires or your mind's relation to it. So in these cases, the choice is optional. To a human being, it's optional. But, that, in other words, broad principles as such don't decide it. But it's not really optional to you, given your context and your values. Now that's the pattern we're going to explore in a few slightly more complicated cases, but that is really the pattern. Now next we're going to go to the dog example. And the paper that we're working from the seminar, lady said, to get a dog. I condensed this. Pets are expensive. They require a lot of attention, but a dog brings tremendous emotional rewards. What is the proper way to approach such a question? Is it worth the inconveniences? What role should your emotions play? Well, here, the two tests. First, the reality test. Now, it's not good enough to say a lot of attention. Why? That is supposed to be the reality factor. But it doesn't do any good in that form. Why not? Well, it's so vague, you have no clear idea. You have to be able to concretize exactly what is going to be demanded of you, what is going to be the negatives or the positives you're going to confront. And a dog involves a substantial change in lifestyle. It's not only that the dog, including his maintenance and vet, is a lot of money. You have to have the time to exercise him, clean him, and be with him. If you don't have the time to spend with him, what's the point? And then the dog is going to have some kind of effect, probably negative, on your furniture, your rugs, your socks, etc. Do you travel a lot? And what happens to the dog at that time? Maybe some breeds are better being shipped back and forth to a kennel than others, and if so, which breeds? Do you have a tiny little apartment? Then you don't want one of these monster dogs. On the other hand, if you don't carry a purse around, you don't want one of these little tiny ones. What about your daughter who is allergic? Is she allergic to all dogs, etc.? Well, as you go through all this, you may find, you know, the negatives are starting to mount up, but you find, well, I'd like a dog, but Jesus. Becoming uneasy, do I really want a dog in the face of all this? Do you find your desire fading as you concretize, or is it intensifying even as you go through? Because remember, at the same time, you're going through the positives. This is also the reality. You're picturing the dog nestled in bed with you at night, and the dog being all excited to go for the daily run, so you're going to get your aerobic exercise in painlessly, and sitting down on the floor and listening to records together and barking when you come home the way dogs do when they go crazy and you feel like you're the king of the universe. Now, if going over that to you, I don't care about the vet and all the troubles, those things are, you know, that's what I really want, then your subconscious is giving you a direction. And most times, if you concretize, if you don't just say a lot of attention and tremendous rewards, which is empty, you can't deal with it, you have to make it specific, concretize, you will find that very rarely does it end up, I still don't know. You'll be pushed in one direction or the other. Your feeling, your subconscious will add it up for you. Now, it is not always easy to concretize the factual data. For instance, to have a child or not, which is a mammoth decision, incredibly more than to have a dog. Before we had a child, we read a book recommended by someone, a thick book called A Baby Maybe. And listed seemingly every possible positive or negative. First of all, it was so complex, it was hard even to take in. You know, 50 changes. I still felt at the end that the decision was essentially unknowable on the basis of this book. I know that it would recommend that it involved a complete change of lifestyle. But how complete was unconcretizable until the baby actually came home and you realized that you were on call 24 hours a day for the next 40 years. And moreover, that nature made a mistake, that babies should be the result of an orgy because two adults cannot full-time look after one. also found that the rewards were absolutely unpredictable. I could not have predicted the joy that are possible under some circumstances, or the rage I get angry at my daughter than anybody else. So I'm not saying, oh, you just sit down and make a list. Sometimes it's extraordinarily complex, but you can't go on exploring until you pass the age of fertility. You explore as much as you can, and then you have to move to the psychological test. We're going back to the dog for a minute. Why do you want the dog? Now here again, one onion skin. And probably the commonest answer is you're lonely and a pet functions as a substitute friend. Now there's nothing whatever wrong with that, as long as you're trying to make friends or find friends and you're having a problem. And you naturally crave some kind of relationship with another consciousness. But the question you have to ask is, what are you going to get from this dog that you don't get from your friends? And you can say a lot of things. This dog cares about me, and he looks me in the eye, and he understands me, and so on. But before you jump to the dog, you have to ask yourself, have you tried to get from your friends what you want? You're lonely, let us say. And is this because, which very well might be the case, the people you meet have problems that turn you off, or you have problems which turn them off, or both? Now, I knew a young girl many, many years ago who loved dogs, and in the course of talking to her, she said she was going to become a vet because she could not deal with people. She couldn't cope with them. She thought they were completely irrational. And for her, becoming a vet was an escape. It was entering into a safe compound, almost like going into a nunnery. It was a retreat from life. Now she, I am not saying there's anything wrong with her getting a pet, but she definitely needed therapy. She has a big problem there, and without doing any work on it, getting the dog is just going to intensify her problem. Now, as applied to the issue of whether to have a child or not, even a one onion skin analysis would invalidate most people's having a child. Because if most people ask themselves, why do I want a child? You would be amazed at the number whose answer is, because my mother expects it, because my neighbors expect it, because I need a second chance at life having wrecked my own, because someone has to love me, swine that I am, and who better than a helpless infant? Now, if any one or all of those are your motives, then you definitely should not have a child. Because here your desire is for something that you cannot attain. You will not attain self-esteem or love or whatever, or another chance at life. All of that is completely invalid. And you'll just make the child miserable in the process. So the introspection would invalidate the choice, even if you could afford it and all the rest. Without a proper motive, don't do it. Because the neurotic motives will not last. Now, you ask me, what is a proper motive? There's a lot of them, and I don't want to turn this into the psychology of parenthood. You might want a child as an expression of the intensity of your love for your wife or husband, and you want a joint creation of the two of you. You might want it from an even narrower egoistic feeling. You want another you that you're going to create in the world, so long as you remember that that other you is not you, and he's got absolute free choice, and he's not to have to go into your career, etc., and so on, or even follow your ideas if he doesn't choose to. Or you might enjoy as an activity teaching, and you want one person that you can teach from beginning to end. That was certainly a motive in my case. to be able to shape somebody's development so far as you can, but you have to be ready to stand right back at signs of resistance, because otherwise, you know, you become overbearing and you defeat your purpose altogether. But let us say you were able to identify some motives that are reasonable. Again, you select from your motives real ones which are reasonable. It's okay if you have mixed motives, as long as the real one is strong enough to carry the choice, the valid one. And then you range over the facts, positive and negative, that are relevant to the decision. Concretize in full reality, and then your emotion will go right away to the thing that you want. The decision will essentially have been made for you in the process. Now, it is complex, especially a thing like having a child, but even choosing a dog. So you have one out to take the pressure off. Very little in life is irrevocable. If you buy the dog, you watch and see what happens. Watch and see if there are new factors that you had forgotten or overlooked, or new feelings that you hadn't predicted or expected. Give it a trial. Do not change your mind the first day or the first week. You have to give it enough of a trial, a month at least for a dog, so you really know what it's like and it's become completely real and how you're responding. And then if you decide it's a mistake, I overlooked so-and-so, this is what I really feel, give them a new home. People do this even about massive choices, like the choice of a career, they change in midlife, or they get divorced and remarry. So even those choices are not irrevocable. This doesn't mean that you make the choice with the cavalier attitude, well, I can always get out of it. Do it as seriously as you can, but you know that with a certain exception, a child is an exception, because once you've made it, you can't say, well, that's too bad, I changed my mind to just get rid of them. But in most choices, you have that minor out. Now let's look at a third example. An apartment, which apartment to get, and this pertains to how to spend your money. We have a student in New York City with a very tight budget deciding between two apartments in the same building. One, I'm quoting from the student, one is clear, comfortable size, $750 a month. The other is nicer, larger, carpeted, air-conditioned, but $950 a month. Now, the second, she writes, would be more comfortable, more like home. You can enjoy spending time in it. But the first suits your minimal needs. On the one hand, you don't want to be short range, remember that, and choose the expensive apartment simply because you want it. But on the other hand, isn't it relevant that you would be happier and more productive in the more expensive apartment? Now, how would you go about making these decisions? That's the question. Now, in these cases, in this particular case, you don't have to worry about introspection if you're remotely normal. Because there are self-evident reasons why any human being in New York would want a carpeted and air-conditioned apartment. I just shudder, because if your apartment is not carpeted, neither is the one above you. And if you know what New York heat gets like, and you're there, I can't say baking, but frying in the humidity, with a clump back and forth over your head, that is not simply, I would be more comfortable in one than the other. You go out of your mind in that circumstance. I would. So the question, I would say, is not an issue of listing advantages and disadvantages. These two in themselves disqualify the apartment unless you're up against it. So the question is strictly money. Can you afford it? And how do you translate that into, this is what qualifies as the factual part, how do you decide whether you can afford it? You simply have to tell yourself one thing, namely, what would you not buy for the $200 a month that you're spending on the rent? What do you not buy to pay for that $200 a month? And then there's a whole range of things, and you've got to list them, and then make clear to yourself that it's the apartment versus this. Now, for instance, in some cases it'll come out, it's just too bad. However horrible the apartment, you can't give up this. On the other case, you may find, I'd rather give up that and have the apartment. Now, for instance, if you find that your food is $200 a month, you can't give that up. And nor would it be wise to live just on pasta and ketchup. For instance, suppose one of the things this girl feels is this is the age of feminism. When she goes out on a date, she likes to pay her own way and even sometimes pay for the man to show the equality of the sexes. Now, in my hierarchy of values, that would certainly be dispensable. I mean, if I were a woman, I'd say I'm fine to let him pay and put the money into a better apartment. But you have to decide according to what you think. What about clothes? Now, suppose you find that you spend $200 a month on clothes. Then you have to ask yourself, what do I get out of clothes? And suppose you find that you get an important sense of yourself out of clothes. You know, a sense of yourself as a romantic being, attractive and so on, and it does something for your self-image. And that is important. And when you think of the concretize the juxtaposition, you have a cool apartment, it's a quiet apartment, and you walk around looking like a schlump. And that strikes you as, I don't want it. You will gradually come to say there's no choice, if that's the price. Now, if it were me, I would go around in jeans and a torn t-shirt rather than hear the people's footsteps, let alone the air conditioning. Is it your tuition that you have to give up? Well, that would certainly wipe out your long range altogether. But here again, proper analysis will push the decision one way or the other. Now, in judging this choice, I want to make the important point, don't underestimate the importance of enjoying life today. I'm going to give you a false argument. Nobody here wants to be a short-range person, right? And here's a false argument. A short-range person, you don't have to write it down, but just listen. A short-range person focuses on the present. I am long-range, therefore the present is of no importance to me. Or here it is again. Being short-range is bad. Being concerned with the present is short-range. Therefore, being concerned with the present is bad. Now, I know a lot of objectivists, conscientious ones, who basically subscribe to that attitude. And to them, I would like to recall Augustine's famous analysis of time, when he said, time is made of the past, the present, and the future. The past no longer exists. The present does not yet exist. All that there is, the future is, does not yet exist. All that there is the present moment. And therefore, he came to some very bad conclusions from that. But the truth is, that is all you will ever be in, because whenever you're in it, that's the present. So if you throw away the present disdainfully, that equals throwing away your life disdainfully. When we say it's bad to be short range, we mean when you use the short range in a way to contradict the long range. When you're, for instance, you're in a long range context, you're choosing a career, say, and your tooth starts to ache, and you say, gee, I need a dentist, and you enroll in dental school. Now that is being short range, because you're taking what should be a long range decision and deciding it on the basis of a pain here and now. Or you're studying for exams, the finals of a crucial course, and someone says, let's take a cruise. You say, sure, why not? That would be a lot of fun. Then you're sacrificing something crucial to your long-range goals in order to have fun. That is a mistake. But there are many things that you do which are short-range, which are done only for the pleasure of the moment. It's not true that everything short-range is wrong. If you're making love and you feel like putting your arms here rather than there, the sole need thing you have to know is, this is where I want to put them now. That is short range and valid. Now, presumably you're not doing that under the suggestion of a psychotherapist that this will work toward the long range, fulfillment of your marriage and resolution of disputes and so on. In the 99 cases out of 100, you're doing it because you want to do that then and there, and it doesn't lead to anything further. So, I am not counseling whim worship, but I am saying that the satisfaction of desire, short and long range, is the essence of life. True, you have to pursue the long range, because otherwise you cannot get the pleasure out of life. Then you become a bum like Adam in the Garden of Eden, just lying around plucking apples off the tree. You have to pursue the long range and have a purpose, but you got to enjoy the pursuit of the long range. You have to enjoy the steps that lead to it, and then enjoy the end result when it comes, and most crucially, in the long trek toward the end, experience every other pleasure that you desire as long as it's compatible with the attainment of that long-range end. In other words, you want to accumulate as much enjoyment as possible on a moment-by-moment basis. That is inherent in a long-range life. So don't sneer at today's comfort, but don't forget tomorrow. And that's the combination you have to keep in mind. Now let's go from that directly to the last example I want to look at, the dissertation problem. It's not restricted to dissertation, but it's most acute. You can put in master's thesis or whatever. Now I've been saying to you that if you clarify your conclusions, your desire will follow from them. But there is one real exception. If other people mandate assignments which you have no say over and do not respect, as in college, for instance, no amount of thinking about it or recognition of its necessity is going to make you want to do it. And I may say this is not restricted to college assignments. Suppose you set yourself a goal that you really want to perform, such as, for instance, write a book on the ominous parallels between Germany and America. But it's agony. You don't yet know how to write. You're learning how to think. You're all mixed up. You will not, certainly not consistently, feel the desire to do it. And even though these cases are very different, the common denominator is there is a natural rebellion against suffering. And you may have a long-term project which, for one reason or another, requires you continually to steel yourself, continually to do the accomplishment by an act of will, even though you're convinced of its value and its importance in your life. And that raises the question, how do you survive while engaged in such a task? That is what we call the dissertation problem. Now, the way this student put it, while working on my dissertation, a friend invites me to a movie. I want to go, but I know that the more I work on the dissertation, the more likely and the sooner it will be approved. How do I know it's legitimate to put the dissertation on hold to do something I enjoy? Many objectivists tell me that they experience guilt when they set aside a long-term project in order to pursue a present desire. For example, to see a movie, visit a friend, or go to a concert. Engaging in such activities, I know, is crucial to your long-term goals. For example, hearing a performance of Rachmaninoff will give you emotional fuel needed to complete the dissertation. So how do you decide whether you are acting on your emotions or whether pursuing these desires fulfills an important objective need? I see people nodding. How many feel guilty if they go to a movie instead of doing their dissertation? And would you feel better if we could say, having gone to that movie, you'll write a better dissertation? I'm sure you would. But that means you have a problem. You are leaving no room whatever for the enjoyment of life in the present. You are judging every action strictly as a contribution to long-range productivity or cognition. Notice that this student says, it's okay to go hear Rachmaninoff because, quote, it will give you the emotional fuel needed to complete the dissertation. So in other words, the standard of value during this period is not man's life, but man's dissertation. And then everything is judged by that. Now presumably this applies to going to the movies, visiting friends, sleeping with friends, etc. All of it is adjusted by, well, if we go to bed, will I write faster tomorrow? Now you see, there is something gravely wrong with that. What justifies all this productivity and cognition? It isn't your enjoyment of life that's thrown out. The end is now productivity. Well, what for? Well, judging from the way these people act, they just pick up the next project then. So they are productive in order to be productive, they learn in order to learn, and they keep going till they die. And that's it. Some of them leave 1 minute after they've been told they're going to die right away and look back, get a quick sense of satisfaction, and then die. Now, a person living like that has set no end or goal in itself. Everything is a means, so nothing is an end. It's a perennial pursuit of a means to nothing. But here's where you must remember that enjoyment is an end in itself. You do not need to justify short-range pleasure in long-range terms. In fact, if I wanted to upset you, I could make the reverse point. Why work for a long-range goal except to expand, enhance, enrich your pleasure in life? And how can you ever experience pleasure except here and now? You must always live and try to enjoy today. And in that sense, although not in the sense in which it was originally meant, I agree with the motto, carpe diem. Have you heard of that? C-A-R-P-E-D-I-E-M. Seize the day. Now, that's usually said by hedonists and wind worshippers to do whatever they feel like doing. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying within the framework of rational desires and long-range goals, seize the day and wring out of it every pleasure possible, as against being a robot who just goes on and on for the next century and the next dimension and the next project. Now, Ayn Rand certainly followed this at the time when she was most involved in her work and working virtually every second. She took time to listen to music. She took time to talk to friends for 10 and 15 hours at a time. I was one of them. She was always aware of living in the present, even though she had 10 and 12 year projects that were moving her. She was so present oriented, for instance, that if you were about to leave, let's say, at the end of an evening, and a negative or unhappy subject came up, something about the world or people, not that every one of those is like, I would, in my early days, I said, well, okay, goodbye, and left. And she would say, no, don't go on this note. Let's talk for 5 minutes on something more benevolent and more positive, just to reestablish the benevolent universe and the good, and not be left with the taste at the end of the whole evening is how hopeless people are. And she would deliberately take that time because she wanted always the focus. Not that she was Pollyanna, she could get furious and if something was bad, it was bad. She wouldn't minimize it, but she certainly believed in the importance of the reality of joy here and now. And that the problem with people coming to this philosophy is that they start off feeling, I can do whatever I want. And they equate that with happiness. Then they learn that you can't. So they say, I won't do anything I want then. I'll just pursue the long-range goal. But you can't do that. And so all that happens is you rebel at some point. You say, objectivism is not going to force me to become one of these repressed drones who works all the time, etc. And then you just flip back to where you started to begin. But those are two false alternatives. The only question about the short range when you're within a long range project is how much time you can afford to spend on the short range. That's the only, I mean, assuming the short range is inherently valid as against some of the examples we've given earlier. How much time can you afford to spend on the short range in any given day, granted you have a serious long-range goal? Well, one observation is there's only so much time you can work creatively and productively in a given day anyway. You're not infinite in terms of your capacities. In a moment of tremendous inspiration, maybe you could do double that. But for instance, I cannot, even in a moment of inspiration, go beyond 6 hours of creative writing, which is what I call work. Business meetings and talking to people on the phone and so on, that you can do, you know, around the clock. But we're talking about writing, creative work. 6 hours is tops. I used to work like from 11 to 1 and then have a half hour for lunch and then go on till whatever it was, 5:30. And that was it. I just had to walk in a sort of blur to get to the car and then try to figure my way home. And I would need a time at the end of the week to feel refreshed and recovered. And I found that I didn't need 2 days, but one was not enough. So I would quit Saturday noon and start again Monday. So you've got to experiment within the limits of your capacity. How much maximum productive work can you get in before you get so tired that you're wasting, you're oversteering, you're not accomplishing what you're after? Your proper daily agenda should be my X hours for creative or difficult work for the long range that I'm pursuing, and then X hours for the necessities of survival. You know, food and shopping and whatever. And the rest, pleasure. So it's not true that every pleasure is stolen. It's got to be in there. It's just a question of how long. And here's where we get to the most important point. in terms of how much time you can afford to spend on the short range. When you undertake a long-range project, and I know this by bitter experience, you must set a realistic completion date, allowing time for daily pleasures along the way. You must set a realistic completion date, allowing time for current pleasures along the way. And then you act according to your progress. For instance, you are ahead 1 week because of the super diligence the week before, or you've got a brilliant idea and the thing wrote itself. Well, now you could take your dog to the calm of the seashore for an extra week. Or you are behind your projection because you were fighting with your mother-in-law over your expensive apartment. So this week, you have to work on Sunday and try and make it up. Now, the completion date, I stress, must be realistic. If it's too short, too close, what's going to happen? You'll be constantly hampered by guilt and panic. It's coming, and I can't do it. If it's too long, that's even worse. Too far in the future, what effect will that have? You will be passive and demoralized. You will be unable to summon up the excruciating effort necessary, because it is excruciating effort if you're doing creative work, because you will feel, oh, there's so much time, I don't have to do it today. I got months to do it. Essential to a long-term project is to know when it's going to be over, and then you can adjust your daily activities accordingly. Now, how do you decide, for instance, I'm writing a book on Germany and America. How much time should I allow it? Well, what I've learned you should do, but I didn't know at the time, break up the project into units and estimate the time as well as you can for each. For example, well, I got to do some research for the book. It's going to involve reading, say, 40 books, and I can skim 3 books a day. Taking time out, etc., let's say we make that 2 months for research. I'm going to have to do an outline. Now, that's very complicated because I have to decide what comes where and so on, but it's only going to be provisional. I should be able to get an outline in a month. Now, I'm going to have, let's say, 12 chapters on my outline. And I know that if I've organized the material and I know what I'm doing, I should be able to average out one type page a day of final copy. Usually you do 5 pages one day and then you go over and over and over it. And at the end of 5 days it averages out. So double it just to be on the safe side. So give yourself for a 50-page chapter 100 days, etc. Then at the end you're going to have to do the footnotes. Toss in another 6 weeks. Now if it's a dissertation, toss in the revisions demanded by your professors, another couple of months. And then let us say 6 months in a mental hospital recovering. But you break it up according to units of months and then add up, and that's your total time. And then you follow as carefully as possible, revising as and when necessary. Obviously, you can get a ballpark. And then you see, oh, I did the first thing in a week. So I went a lop a month off. Everything is up a month. Or I did the first thing, it took me 5 months instead of 3. Now I have to expand. But in revising, you must keep one thing in mind. You can only expand your time frame within very definite limits. There must be an absolute outer time limit. And if you write nothing else today, I would write that. There must be an absolute outer time limit. At which point you say, If it's not done by then, I quit. That's it. The only exception to this is if you're writing the magnum opus of your life. In other words, this book is your life. And you would be content to write it and die. Well, then nobody can put a limit on it. But if it's anything else, if it's a means to another end, and you have a whole bunch of other things you want to do in your life, you cannot ascribe infinity to any project as the outer limit, or you will simply waste your entire life. Now, a dissertation, for instance, I can see a year. I can see a year and a half in complicated cases working on the side and so on. I can see 3 years. But if somebody tells me I've got 15 years to do my dissertation, and say, number one, you'll never finish. And number two, you'll never finish because he's guaranteeing it by allowing himself a schedule of that kind. Now, I did not entirely follow my own advice here, but I didn't realize its importance on the ominous parallels. I undertook that book in the spring of 1968 with the understanding that it would be published in September of 68 in time for the Nixon-Humphrey presidential election. And I actually finished it in 1980, 12 years later. Now, there were reasons, and I learned a great deal, but still, I would not do, if I had to do over again, spend 12 years on a first book after I saw it was taking that long, I'd say, I'm going to take an easier project first. Learn the skills of writing and thinking, and then apply those to a more complicated book. The result of that was, having taken so long, when the time came up for tenure, I didn't have enough published to qualify, and I basically forfeited a teaching career which I wanted because I was still slogging away a chapter a year. Now, I learned my lesson when I got to OPAR. I gave myself exactly 6 months per chapter, counting doing other speeches and having a child and etc. And I finished right on schedule. So what I want to tell you is persistence is an ambiguous virtue. It's great to persist and keep slugging if it's within a defined context, but persistence in a vacuum is not a virtue, and it's a form of kidding yourself if you keep saying, next year for sure, I'll finish it. So to sum up here, the goal in all cases where you have to apportion your time, your money, your vacation, your dog, whatever it is to integrate your emotions with your perception of reality so that as closely as possible, you are always doing what you want to do and simultaneously you are always following reality. And the key to there being no opposition is that your desires follow from reality by the act of your observing the facts, you shape your desires, and your introspection follows from reality, from your basic choice to live. And you approve of it, and to live means to remain in reality. And if you follow that, you'll see that the inner and the outer, you're being guided by a desire based on reality and facts that you perceive in reality. And that is the real meaning of objective values in practical life. If you are an intrinsicist, you don't know what to do with options. Because reality is, you're supposed to just passively wait for reality to tell you. So the intrinsicist has no room for options. They believe in repression, and they just wait allegedly to get the intuition of what to do. The alternative is the subjectivist, who has no room for reality, and simply says, follow your emotions, whatever they are. Now, the real alternative is follow your emotions, once those emotions themselves have two streams, reality and, psychologically, your commitment to remain in it. In that case, you are being objective, neither intrinsic nor subjective, and you will not be tortured because the very fact that what you're choosing is the focus on reality will lead you to a pro-reality conclusion without torture. And that, I think, should help to set you free from this wicked dichotomy of emotionalism versus repression. Okay. Let's draw a line, give you 30 seconds to erase your consciousness. And spend a couple of minutes finishing this homework up, and then we'll be able to have questions. And you can get your questions ready. They can be on either lecture, obviously, since we didn't have questions last time. I'll give you just a few seconds to I want, before we go to the question period, to say a few words in conclusion about the homework assignment that I gave you. You have two friends. You've admired them both for years. You think highly of each. They've had a bitter falling out, which they each say is not a matter of personality or incompatibility, but that the other has done wicked things or evil things, or at minimum the other is immoral, and they refuse to deal with each other. And you, we saw last time, cannot escape this situation. You have to judge. And yet, when you go to the two friends, you get directly contradictory reports. Now, if the dilemma or the dispute was entirely ideological, and you, one group or individual would say, I hold such and such, and the other one would say, I hold such and such, then that becomes strictly a question of philosophic analysis. It doesn't make any difference who said what or whatever. It's reduced to a cut and dried philosophic dispute, and you can see whether you regard it as honest, dishonest, crucial, or not. But that's not what we're talking about here. The people involved may say that the other side acted against objectivism, but neither individual came out and preached the rejection of objectivism, so you can't resolve it strictly on the basis of their formal ideas. You're given, therefore, contradictory reports from the two parties. You weren't there. How do you, you have to judge. How do you judge? Well, I'm going to rattle off for you a few criteria. The simplest would be if you had tangible physical evidence that was independent of anybody's reports. That's the so-called smoking gun. Now, if you could get like the DNA that they have in the OJ trial, that would be great. It is, however, very hard to find in non-criminal situations. It's possible. One party can tell you what happened when he was in Chicago, and you can discover that he never went to Chicago, or that another party threw a rock at him, and you find out that the other party had broken his arm and was in a cast and couldn't throw a rock. I mean, a plain out physical discrepancy like this is a simple resolution of the whole dilemma, but it's hard to find. A second criteria: are there any other witnesses to the relevant facts beyond the two parties? Now, if witnesses attest dominantly to what one party says and not another, and you know something about the reliability of the witnesses, that becomes a real indication. But it may not be decisive. Because if it is a big issue, friends gather around friends, and there virtually inevitably will be two sides. And there may very well be witnesses who witnessed what other witnesses didn't witness according to the way they wanted to come out. Or there may be errors committed by both parties, and one witness is focusing on one side and one on the other. You know, they say there's two sides to every story. That is not necessarily true, but sometimes there are, and it's very hard for you to elicit. On the whole, I would say it's not a helpful slogan, there are two sides to every story. Because essentially, even if both sides did something regrettable, you will generally find that one is the culprit in essence, and the other overreacted or maybe did something less significant that provoked it, but that I don't ever remember a case where there were two equally balanced sides in my life. Now, we get to two other tests which I think are easier and cleaner to apply. Can you identify any lies in either person's statement? And a lie can take the form of an internal contradiction. He said so-and-so on Wednesday morning, and then on going over the story, on Tuesday night when he said so-and-so, you say, well, is it Wednesday morning or Tuesday night? If anything hinges on that, that is an internal contradiction. One out-and-out lie wrecks the person's credibility on everything. And this actually is embedded in the California Evidence Code, and I think is a perfectly, perfectly legitimate way to decide. If somebody tells an out-and-out lie, now we're not talking about a white lie and so on, or just a sloppy formulation, but an out-and-out lie designed to cover their tracks or cover up what they've done or ingratiate themselves with this person or that person, then their credibility as such is doomed. It does not mean every other thing they say is false, but it does mean every other thing they say is outside the realm of cognition. We no longer can entertain it because the source is self-invalidating. And you will find that the typical way to discover these lies is by questioning people. And you will find, well, one person said, he told me X. And the other will gas and say, well, he told me non-X. And this is the typical pattern of a liar. A liar can't tell the same lie to everybody. He's in the position that he's got to count on the weaknesses and the strengths. So one lie will not be believed by somebody else. So he'll tell that person the truth. But somebody else, the truth will be very inconvenient to, and he'll put a lie in. If and when those two people get together and they find that they're told opposite things, and if that happens several times, you know you've got a manipulator, somebody who's preying on people and changing, trimming, altering his story accordingly. That is very, very crucial. And the typical method of a manipulator is to keep his friends compartmentalized so that the friends he sees in this don't meet the friends he sees here, etc. And therefore, he has his own separate stories and relations. And I have seen several cases in my life where through an accident of timing or of scheduling, a group of these separate compartments happened to meet each other and got to talking about somebody. And they were just blown away at the things that the other person said, and each said, that's impossible. He couldn't have said that. I said, what do you mean he couldn't? I know as a certainty he said that. And then finally, when the person in question was confronted, they couldn't say anything. They didn't even attempt, because the whole thing was hopeless on its face. And they, as I remember, this particular person just went upstairs, packed, and moved. That was it. So that's very important if you can find a lie. But now, to get this problem out of the way once and for all, you've got to judge. And let's make the problem the worst you can imagine. Contradictory stories, serious charges, no smoking gun, no convincing witnesses, no detectable perjury. You've got to decide. Now, what then? And my answer then is, you have to decide on the basis of the mind and soul of the two parties involved, as you know them. You can't know them more than you know them. If you don't know them very well, then you had no business being that kind of friend. We're assuming these are people you've known a long time, that you admire, and that you know as well as anybody gets to know anybody. Even if you live with someone for 20 years and sleep with them, there's a sense in which there's things you don't yet know. But you know them well enough. I said the only way to decide is on the basis of your knowledge of the mind and soul of the two parties involved. You've tried every other kind of evidence. It's not there. So then you have to review all that you know about their past and their present that would conceivably be relevant to this situation. Their character, their motivation, their understanding of ideas, the integration or lack of it between their ideas and their lives, their achievements, their failings. And very important here is the quality of their thinking, the precision of their language. Or, well, I think you're getting a class from Harry Binswanger on psychoepistemology. That's very important, the automatized way of thinking. Because you are being given charges that depend on he said and she said. And the one that has the clearest epistemology is the most likely one to be giving you an accurate, unbiased report. It's not a guarantee, but it's the most likely. So you have to check whatever you know that might affect the clarity and factuality of the reports. Whatever you know now, not about the content of the reports, but about the psychoepistemology of the reporter. Does one of them engage in flights of rationalism, where he kind of takes off from reality and just constructs a whole case? Is one of them more objective, more tied to the actual facts of reality? And then looking at other points, is one of them super sensitive? Have you seen cases where he takes offense perhaps too easily? Is one of them overly aggressive, to the point where maybe some kind of motivational problem might be suggested, even though you never really focused on it till this moment? Does one of them have a history of fighting with people? Now, you know, that could be two different things. They said that Rourke was on trial all his life. That's because he's great and he's up against a mediocre world, but it can also be the case that you fight with people all the time because you can't get along with anybody because you're obnoxious. So, if there is a history of antagonizing people, what kind of history? What kind of people? Does one of them have a motive that is perceivable, detectable by you, that might be relevant to their behavior in this instance? Like an obvious financial motive, or a motive of envy, or a motive of status, etc. Now, this is a tremendous amount, but it would occur to you when you think over in the context of the problem, a lot of possible things will occur to you. And what you basically have to do is think it over and then choose between on the basis of the totality of the evidence that is available to you. I think that both parties in this kind of dispute have a right to ask this of you, and you have an obligation to do it if you purport to be friends with both. Each of them has a right to feel of the contending parties, well, if you know me, you will understand that I wouldn't do these things and make these charges without a basis. And the other, let's assume the other feels that too. At which point, when you made your conclusion, I think you're in honor bound to tell both parties, A and B. You have to, which is not pleasant, but you have to say in one form or another, it's come down in my mind to an issue of who do I most accept as a relayer of evidence as total individuals. You are you, and on the basis of everything, I choose A for so-and-so reasons. Now, obviously, B is going to be affronted, and that is not going to do much for your friendship with B. And in all practical terms, it will end it. But if B is rational, he should be able to understand your predicament and the basis why you, in your context, with your knowledge, picked A. And by the way, if you are open in that way, you leave the possibility that if you should find new evidence, you're free to reappraise and inform the parties. You've made your case on the basis of evidence. Neither side thinks he loves me blindly or he hates me blindly. Both expect you to go by evidence. Although in a case like this, if you do make a decisive claim, what usually happens is you just don't see B anymore. He disappears. Now, the way that you may try to get out of this is to say, well, what if these two people are absolutely identically equal in everything, psychoepistemology, personality, character, motivation, you name it. I just flatly deny it. And I would then accuse you of unacceptable generality in your generalizations and evaluations of people. Two peas in a pod are not identical, let alone two human beings. So if you find two people and you say, but they're exactly the same, it's inconceivable for one to be better than the other, I say the reason you're in that position is because you're defining things in very gross terms. Big achievement. Strong individualist. Likes reason. Now, if you use, you know, soundbite definitions, you know, soundbite the way politicians do it, of course you can have interchangeable people, but if you have to break that down, big achievement. What was the big achievement? You got through grade school? You know, likes reason. Well, does he use reason and, you know, et cetera and so on? In what ways? With what complexity? And so if you break it down, you will never find two people that are interchangeable. You can find two people that you like equally. But here you're trying to get behind the liking and find out who is guilty, who is the, according to the total of the evidence, is guilty. That's basically what I want to say about that. And just to conclude that last lecture, here then is a situation where you must judge, but it's hard, it's difficult, and many people are tempted to rationalize. We don't know enough, I'm not involved, the onus of proof, I don't have to judge. And against that, there were the situations that we mentioned in the early part last time where you do not have enough information to judge and you should suspend judgment until you find out more, yet many people plunge in and condemn righteously, or on the other hand, they would plunge in and praise, overpraise, because they see he likes his wife or he likes his children, he gives his children the fountainhead to read, he must be a great person. So the moral is that moral judgment is difficult. It requires scrupulous factual study and courage. Factual study so you know what you're doing, and courage because you're sticking your neck out. You're saying somebody is wrong, somebody is bad. In the worst case, somebody is evil. What can you do? You cannot escape the necessity of either of these, the cognitive and the moral component, the analysis and the courage. But if you do try to integrate the evidence available to you and then to act accordingly, you are a moral judge. And nobody can ask for more. So on that note, I wish you good luck and thank you. All right, now we've got, let's say, 30 minutes for questions. So we'll go to 12:37. And anybody that wants to leave for lunch, no hard feelings, you can just walk out at any time. Go ahead. You're doing it two mics, is that it? So you take one from one mic and one from the other? Okay, the front mic, yeah.
What would you recommend doing in cases where you've seen very suspicious and questionable behavior on the part of somebody who's respected by quite a few of your friends? Would you mention it? How would you mention it? What would you make of it where the behavior isn't conclusive of anything, but it gives you strong reason to question them?
You'd have to give me, I can only answer vaguely unless you give me something specific.
Okay, you've seen somebody who doesn't seem very alert in situations where he should be. He seems kind of, let's say drunk or stoned or something. But in other situations, he's quite well focused, but you're concerned, you're concerned about his commitment to just being alert and aware when he should be, and leads you to question other things about his character, let's say.
Do you have other corroborating evidence?
No, sometimes he's like that, like you've seen him that way.
Other issues besides being drunk?
This alone is enough.
Okay.
Where he's
so
not very much in focus.
Your question amounts to, if you see something that is not self-evidently evil, but raises doubts or suspicions, what should you do about it? And my answer to that would be, note it. And file it in your subconscious. And then whether to pursue it or not, entirely depends on what kind of relationship you're going to have with this person. Are you hiring them as a babysitter? Then that is really important, because you don't want a babysitter that's going to be drunk or stoned. So you have to find out. But how are you going to find out? That in itself can be complicated, because if you say to him, how much of the time are you drunk? He's probably going to say, I am not drunk, I was high, I was feeling good, of course I don't do it during the day, and that might be entirely true. So you'd have to find out about from other sources, or you'd have to say, look, I can get 100 babysitters, and it's just not worth it to even investigate. So maybe he really is innocent, but he's given me the appearance of a problem, and so I disqualify him on that ground. But if it's not that, it's just you're getting to know him, you simply watch across time. I certainly would not have an affair with him when you have questions of that dimension. But I'd like to find out, first of all, I make a big distinction between being drunk and being stoned. I'm old-fashioned enough to be entirely opposed to being stoned, but I don't put alcohol in the same category. In terms of its deleterious or harmful effects. What qualifies as being drunk? Sometimes a person can be in total despair and you feel totally sympathetic and they just drink themselves into oblivion. Now, if that becomes a way of life, you know, that is bad. But you can think of cases in the Fountainhead and in We the Living where that took place. Sometimes a person becomes tipsy just for sheer joy, for instance, at finishing their dissertation. Now, objectivism is not a temperance society. And you do not measure character by how many ounces of rye goes down in how many hours. You have to get the context and the meaning. But if you think a person is overly dependent on alcohol, and it becomes a trait that without any perceivable, you know, crisis or whatever, he's in and out and he's aware and he's not, you keep your eye open. If you get to know him well enough, ask him about it. Is he defensive? Does he say he is a problem and he wants to go to AA? And you have to judge according to the continuing evidence. There's no one answer. Well, if you're suspicious, go to the FBI and look it up. You have to define your suspicion in relation to whatever else you know about him and to the possible interpretations of it. Mm-hmm. And then just file and watch. And that's how you get to know something.
Yeah. In the cases where you have enough evidence to be suspicious but not have any firm conclusions, is it worthwhile or proper to mention it to other people who may know the person?
It's certainly, if it's public behavior, it's worthwhile to, if you're interested, if you have a reason to be interested, to say, you know so-and-so, I saw him in this condition, what does it mean? But I wouldn't make it a, like the Hugh Grant of your life. You know what I mean? Where that's, you know, your obsession, and because it shouldn't be of that interest to you. A casual inquiry is one thing. But I would more commonly, if I had an actual suspicion about someone, and I didn't know much about them, I would just let them go on that basis and not pursue it. On the grounds that there's millions of people, and I have a bad first impression, I'm not going on the, you know, TV and saying this person is evil. I'm just saying it's not worth it to me to pursue it any further. It would be like reading the first chapter of a book. Maybe it gets better, but it's not worth it. It's just not good enough to hold my interest. Now let somebody else have it in the back there.
All right. You speak of a consciousness test as opposed to a reality test, and I wanted to see if you would agree with the way in which I put this, because you weren't entirely clear. Is it that you identify the aspects of the potential vacation, say, that appeal to your emotional associations and thereby your associations in words as much as possible, and then act on the basis of the some feeling that you get after you have put all of that into words? For example, you're thinking of visiting a farm and you say, well, I've always liked chickens, want to get woken up in the morning, you know, by their sounds, and then as a result of your considering this, you feel more and more enthusiastic about going to the farm, or is it some, in your model, does it go through some different process that I've not
well,
seen
I don't
correctly.
Exactly recognize what I said in your summary. Mm-hmm. When you go through the facts, it's not from the point of view of does it appeal to your emotional association. The question is simply, are you aware of the facts? The cost, the time, the requirements of getting to the place.
Well, that's the reality test. I'm talking about the consciousness test.
As to the consciousness test, it's not enough to appeal to an association or a sum of associations. You can't say, well, when I think of a farm, I get a kick from a chicken. And then roosters will leave me more or less indifferent. I hate walking in bird dew. If you do it that way, you are never going to know, because there's 100 different concretes. You have to look at the farm as a whole and see what it dominantly stands for to you. If you're trying to elicit your own response, It can't be to every sub-microscopic element within the farm. It has to be a farm as against a city or a mountain or whatever.
So nonetheless, you are identifying in words your basic feelings and associations towards the farm.
I don't accept the word association, because association sounds like a purely blind accidental connection as a result of the way you were brought up or had your earlier experience. The two things were juxtaposed and you just continuously associate them. Like the first girl that ever slapped your face was blonde, so from this point on, since you're a masochist, you like blondes. That is unacceptable as thinking, and that will certainly not elicit a rational emotion. If you're asking if I like blondes, do not look for association. And if all you can come up with is association, that is not a good reason.
Well, what are you distinguishing from the emotions that result from associations?
Emotion should be a response to the actual essence of the entity being considered. And you should be able to show that this response follows from, as for instance, the calm seashore. Now, by calling it the calm seashore, she's focusing on what she wants. And she doesn't want calm simply because calm is associated with inheriting $1 million. It's not an issue of association. It's in the nature of what calm would mean to her.
As long as you're on the
level of association, you have not yet reached the level of introspection. But that would take us into a long discussion of introspection. Introspection is not simply, a stream of consciousness. It has to be done in essentialized terms.
So you're saying, what does this symbolize?
Pardon?
You're saying, what does this symbolize?
What is it I'm responding to, and why do I evaluate it as positive or negative? And if all I can say is association, that's not good enough. Okay, in the front.
Just a quick statement and then my question. While I recognize your sadness at not getting tenure, my own rational selfishness is glad that you were able to spend more time on objectivism for the general public.
Well, thank you, but it's not either or.
Now to my question. In the choosing between the two people, is it conceivable that you psychoepistemologically had already made the decision before the conflict between the two people even came up? And that you then brought it into consciousness.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, that happens more often than not. That you've been uneasy about somebody in that subliminal way that Betsy mentioned. There was something bothering you, but you couldn't put your finger on what it was. And suddenly, when you're confronted with there's a major issue here, you focus back with a more skeptical eye on the things that you've seen through the years, and you realize that you know yourself. You have a more negative estimate than you thought. That, unequivocally, I've gone through that process. And it's, makes it easier if that's happened. But also, I've gone through where it didn't happen. Yeah.
My question has to do with sense of life. My understanding is that it's at the base of all of your emotions. Okay, and it may be synonymous with core evaluation, I'm not sure. But I'd like a complete list of what you consider core evaluations or the questions which can... I don't think there's that many, maybe four or five.
I can't do it because I am not a psychologist. To take an inventory of your basic ideas that shape your psychology is outside of my knowledge and ability. That would take a theoretical psychologist who was able to show not only that people hold these fundamental views, but why they have to, why these are the only ones, which is primary, which is secondary, how they're interconnected, how they influence others, etc. That would be a description of the workings of human consciousness. A philosophy covers only the procedures your consciousness has to go through in order to achieve cognition. So I'm not omniscient.
Yeah, I have a problem with the friends case. I don't see why you couldn't just tell them both the following. Look, you know, I've listened to both of you. I respect both of you. I don't see any dishonesty. I don't see any contradictions. But this whole situation means that I have to now look more carefully from now on. I'm just basically putting you both on notice. I'm sorry if you're pissed off with me, but the facts are such that I don't have conclusive proof.
Phil, I don't want to reiterate what I've already done, so you cannot answer my answer. You can sit down and I'll tell you my answer to that point. It is conceivable that there's a situation where you think both parties have gone off the deep end in terms of what they're doing, and you think neither should have been so upset. But I would say to you that that is so rare as to be virtually negligible in a discussion of judging people. If these two people, remember the situation, who you've known for a long time and admired for their rationality, have uttered such severe and serious charges against each other, you are in no position to come in and say, I, Phil Coates, who know nothing about the situation, have come to the conclusion that it's a tempest in a teapot. You know that you are ignorant by definition of the situation. Well, how you can convert your ignorance to there's nothing there to know is the fallacy of argumentum ad ignorantium. As I set it up, you can't. What you're saying is exactly the formula for evasion of moral judgment. It is exactly like the OJ jury saying, well, the defense makes a great case and the prosecutor makes a great case, and I wasn't there. How do I know? So a plague on both your houses. And then the judge defines that as reasonable doubt, so he gets off. That is completely unacceptable. The back.
Yes, rather than the two friends, what if it was a husband and wife and you're the child?
I think I mentioned that in the class. But in case you didn't hear it or I threw it away too quickly, a child in relation to his parents is in a very different position. For one obvious reason, he is a child. And a child cannot be asked to judge morally the behavior and actions of adults whose context, purposes, and values he cannot comprehend, or can comprehend, you know, only in a very limited way. Therefore, a child cannot be asked to pick unless the good and evil are on the perceptual level so that they are easily available to him. For instance, if one parent is sexually abusing the child and he is old enough to grasp what's going on and doesn't like it, and this fact comes out, and he can certainly be asked in a case like that. You know, the judge says you cannot stay with that parent. You understand the reason why. And a reasonable child with whatever regret is going to be able to say, I don't want to be with that with that parent who maltreats me. Or if one of them is a drunk who characteristically gets angry and beats him up. On that level, a child can be asked, but the typical disputes that adults have are not reducible to the perceptual level.
No, I was thinking
The other thing involved is that the child, in the 99 cases out of 100, has seen in his own terms, it's not a situation that he has seen unbroken rational behavior. He's probably seen a hash of broken promises, you know, kindness, sudden abrupt changes, fights that don't mean anything, etc. It's impossible for him to try to untangle any of it. And therefore, he can't be asked in a case like that. Over and above that, a child has one crucial thing, and that is the blood tie. And until the evidence is really powerful, he is entitled to place tremendous weight on that. Combined with the fact that he is dependent, through no fault of his own, on these parents for survival. You cannot therefore say to him, we brought you into existence. You can't make head or tail of this. Now, you pick which one is good and which is evil, and the other one's going to say goodbye and leave you here to starve. I mean, that is completely unfair. So that there are many things, the example I gave would be applicable, but only if reduced to the perceptual level. But as an example, mine is entirely dependent on freestanding individuals in a context of admiration who find moral, serious moral charges. That is absolutely not the example you're mentioning. Yes.
How would you apply the principle of long and short range values, objective valuing, to the following specific example of the dissertation issue? Instead of a dissertation, let's say the long range project is fixing your own psychology. And instead of the question of a movie, the question is a romantic relationship. And the issue is, since the joy you get from a romantic relationship depends on your psychological health, do I wait until I'm fully psychologically healthy to start? Or if I have an opportunity in the middle of the process, and let's say you started out really messed up, what do you...
Well, I want to get one thing straight at the outset. Do you mean that fixing your own psychology is a long-range project, or it is the long-range project, which is the center track of your life and everything else revolves around it?
A long-range project.
Okay, so I don't have to make a speech on why that can't be the motif of your life.
No.
So, you have psychological problems, and your question is, do you have to solve them first before you have a romantic relationship? Or can you say, I'll get the pleasure of a short-range romantic relationship as I'm working on the long range.
Assuming you take romantic relationships seriously,
yes.
And ideally...
You're taking it seriously, yeah. I understand. I would have to say it entirely depends upon your capacities and your problem. What is the nature? I'm not asking you to answer me now, I'm just saying it rhetorically. It is depends upon the nature of your long-range problem. If it's simply tangentially related to romance, in other words, everything obviously redounds on a person's sex life. Every problem does. So if you took the line, first of all, fix yourself and then have a sex life, that would end all romantic relations. If you have some self-doubt, that will affect your sex life, you know, whatever it is. But we're assuming that you have a long-range problem that has some direct bearing on your sex life. I would have to know, or you would have to know, the person deciding would have to know, what is the bearing? Does it put you in a position that you only want, I'll put this abstractly, forms of sexual satisfaction that you think are neurotic and harmful? If so, I would certainly try to see where you could go in improving before you plunge in and simply intensify and habituate something you're trying to fight. On the other hand, there's a very tricky thing. Suppose the psychologist tells you that thanks to the primitive state of psychotherapy and psychology in general as it is today, 50 years of regular therapy is required before you would be ready to enjoy a healthy sex life. And you're 45, let's say. No, seriously. Then you have to say, well, look, this is the way reality is. For whatever reasons, I got screwed up. I don't know any way to get there faster. Sex is a tremendous value. I can't get it properly, and I'm not going to become an ascetic. Therefore, I won't lie, you know, whoever or whatever my partner is. I'll be open, you know, not necessarily in the sense that I'll put it in the newspaper, but I'm not going to. But I'll do what I have to do, even if my pleasure is not as great as theoretically it would be when I'm 95. You know, I've got to do it now. So it all depends on your age, your problem, how much it impacts on your sexual life, etc. But I would never say to be, and this is consistent with what I said here, put off that major a dimension of life indefinitely while solving your problem. Nor would I say, what's the difference? Pleasure in the present is what counts. Go ahead, to hell with your problem. I mean, what if your problem is tremendous pleasure in strangling your victim or your partner? So, not you, but one. So, it's highly contextual. It's the best I can say. The good thing about philosophy is general answers are all you can give. In the back.
I'd like to ask a question that goes back to the first lecture. About the degrees of evil, where you spoke about and compared the evil of Kant to the evil of Hitler, for
yes.
example. It brought to mind to me evaluating the evil of someone like the Pope, meaning not the particular guy who's Pope now, but the Pope in general down through the ages. Would the evil that resulted from his existence and influence over mankind be equated with that of Hitler or Kant, even though it's more abstract and passed through many more stages before the final results of it were apparent?
Do I think that the popes through the ages have been as evil as Hitler or Kant? No, I do not. First of all, all of Christianity in all branches, including Catholicism, is relatively speaking innocent in contrast to Kant. Christianity always had better elements. For instance, the stress on the individual soul as against the communal collectivism which was taken for granted in the pagan world. And above all, the fact which Kant criticized that Christianity held out to men a selfish long-range motivation. They said you should be after the salvation of your own soul, and that if you behaved morally, you would be rewarded in heaven with an eternity of joy. Now, this was a nakedly selfish motivation. True, it's otherworldly. In this life, you're supposed to suffer and obey. But the idea was, in the end, you're going to be paid well, whereas the people, you know, that are doing well now, they're going to suffer in the future. Now, mystical as that is, it still has the common sense idea that the wages of virtue is happiness. That was what remained in Christianity from ancient Greek. From the ancient Greek approach. And to that extent, Christianity always remained innocent. What Kant brought in was the final extirpation of happiness. Kant said, if you aim at happiness, even happiness in heaven, if what you want is a salvation of your own soul, you're just the same as Al Capone. You are just a selfish nothing, amoral. You deserve no credit. What you have to do is aim at misery. You have to positively pursue a life of rending self-sacrifice. So you have to read my book, The Ominous Parallels, the chapter on the ethics of evil. I make this point there. How much more evil Kant is in terms of the power of destruction, in terms of removing morality from reality and from life, than the popes were. Now, certainly the popes, most of them were evil, although some of them, you know, within the framework of that institution, were patrons of the arts, nurtured great works, were more enlightened, were more civilized. You know, there's been fascists and popes across hundreds of years. But if you think of it simply as the time that they had power, they certainly used it in malignant ways to keep the earth dark, but they did not approach the intellectual devastation of the modern era, and they did not have the technology to approach the massive destruction of the modern era. So in that sense, they were not comparably evil to Kant. Now we have, where is my boss?
Five.
We still have five? Okay. Go.
Regarding today's lecture, you mentioned the phrase carpe diem. Do you have a recommendation or comment on the Dead Poets Society movie?
The Dead Poets Society movie? I remember being enraged by that movie, and I'm trying to recreate why. I saw it years ago, and all I can remember is that these kids were encouraged to take an individualist stand, and then one after the other they were cut down, and the only ones, now I may be getting it wrong, but it was like the only ones that survived were the ones who compromised, and it was a kind of a dramatization despite the intention. The intention was supposed to be the nobility of individualism, but every authentic individualist in the piece had a horrifying ending of one kind or another, and all the compromisers succeeded. And what it basically was a movie saying there's an inexorable clash between the moral and the practical, and if you don't give up your ideals and compromise with the system, you're going to die or fail. That's what I remember, and that's what enraged me about that movie. I also don't think Robin Williams is ideal as Mr. Chips. Yes, in the back.
My question goes back to the degrees of evil from the last lecture. You've said Kant is the evilest man in history, worse than Hitler or Stalin. Since Hitler and Stalin together have murdered hundred million people, up close to that. Are you saying that irrationality, evasion, and its advocacy are worse than murder, particularly mass murder? If you are not saying that...
Oh, well, they don't have to say any further. I don't care for questions where you're giving me a dilemma. If I say this, I'm hung on this, and if I say this, I'm hung on that, because I don't say either of them. So just stop right there and let me answer that.
Okay.
As thought is the question, which is worse, thought or action? You can't ask that question because it's whose thought and what kind of action. I was talking in a specific situation where I presume you have the evidence that Kant's thought made the action of Hitler and Stalin possible. And if there had been no Kant, and no Kantian development, therefore, no Hegel, Fichte, Schopenhauer, that whole line, if Aristotle had been the new presence, and you had had an intensification of the Enlightenment through the 19th and 20th century, you would never have had mass collectivist movements with mass slaughter. And therefore, it's not thinking is worse than action. It's that type of thinking is what unleashed this type of action. And therefore, Kant and Hitler and Stalin are as evil as you can get. They are the men who did the butchering. But from the point of view of the primary cause, Kant is even more evil because he did the evading, the institutionalizing of the evading, and let them do the killing. And you think about that. Yes.
My question goes back to the first lecture when you had asked Ayn Rand the question about someone's choice of a particular woman as a mate that you tread very lightly in judging that other person based on who they choose for a mate. And I think that perhaps, well, I'd like you to elaborate on that. And also I'm curious about this incalculable sexual pleasure that you can't judge without knowing more as her answer. I just would like
some
elaboration.
Well, maybe I didn't make her viewpoint clear. Her viewpoint is that you cannot tell from a drawing room encounter, what is the value that the man and the woman see in each other? What sense of life affinity do they have that they may never have found anywhere else? I did not mean to suggest that it was something you could get out of how-to books, and that one of them had a technique that really blew the mind of the other. It was put in terms of everyone, and certainly good people, are looking for something, some kind of response, some kind of understanding, some kind of community or kinship or intimacy with another person. And it may very well be the case that a woman who seems undistinguished, unintellectual, nothing in particular in the drawing room, is able in the setting of a private relationship to offer a man legitimate values that he can get nowhere else and that you can't see evidence of in the drawing room. And therefore, if you know the woman inside out, or that's perhaps an unfortunate. You know the woman well, then certainly it becomes relevant to your judgment of him that he's in love with her. But we were talking in the typical situation. You meet people for dinner and afterwards, you know, well, what did you think of them? And they'd say, well, I liked him, but why he would marry her is beyond me. And I've had that experience I don't know how many times. Even in reverse, but usually the man is better than the wife. But I've had it certainly in reverse too. And you would just chat and say, I don't know. Her general rule was, don't use the impression the wife makes in a drawing room as evidence about the man's essential character. If I didn't make that clear, I'm glad to have done it. Now you're on. That's it. Thank you very much. Thank you very much.